Okay, now, and I also want to mention too, because you don't really hear too much about it, but you always hear sort of some discussion, and that's your eyes wide shut examination.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really interesting because you just don't hear too many people. You hear people talk about it, but only in roundabout ways. So I'm glad someone took the time to look into the movie and really dissect it. That's for people who are listening to the interview. If you liked Eyes Wide Shut and you're into the esoteric world, this is a great read, and that's part of the B stuff.
Yeah, that piece has really resonated with a lot of folks, particularly people who suspect they've been or claim that they've been victims of mind control.
Yeah.
Once again, I've done a lot of research into mind control and what certain people claim are different programming matrices that are used. For instance, imagery from the Wizard of Oz appears to have been used in a lot of these mind programming scenarios, stuff of that nature. So when I finally saw Eyes Wide Shut, I saw all these things going on in the film that seemed to be allusions to what is known as Monarch mind control programming. So I basically just went through the film, and everything I noted, or everything I saw in there, I made a note of it and put it all into this article and kind of ran with it, just threw my impressions out there. And I don't know if I'm totally accurate I am, but I definitely touched a nerve there. And so, probably out of all the articles in the book, it's the one I continually get feedback on from different people.
Oh, no kidding, really?
Yeah.
That's pretty interesting. And what do you think Kubrick was up to there? Do you think he knew something? First of all, do you think he knew something? And then sort of does that lead to, do you think that that led to his demise?
Yes, and possibly. I think he obviously had some knowledge of these esoteric things involved with, the whole Monarch mind control and MK Ultra. Whether it had something to do with his death is quite possible, but I don't think anybody's really investigated that too deeply. I certainly couldn't say definitively or conclusively that's attributed to his death, but it's certainly very possible.
Yeah, it seems kind of mysterious. And if you kind of look at his work leading up to that, he sort of shines light on some stuff that's pretty esoteric in and of itself.
Yeah.
Especially now I'm thinking about Clockwork Orange when they try to give bend that guy's mind pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
So, yep. Maybe for all we know, Kubrick could have, he probably had an inside track somewhere into what was going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, and what some conspiracy theorists suggest, for instance, there's a guy named Michael Anthony Hoffman who's written quite a bit about this and what he calls the revelation of the method, or the making manifest of all that's unseen. And it's basically what he says, it's a Freemason conspiracy, or a conspiracy by the cryptocracy, that they're basically running Hollywood and using these movies to slowly over a period of time reveal what's going on behind the scenes to the public. And by the time the public understands exactly what's going on behind the scenes, it'll be too late.
Yeah, actually, you must be like some kind of mind reader here, because on the list here of talking points is Michael Hoffman, because as soon as I saw you cited Michael Hoffman, I was psyched, because I'm a huge fan of his book. I forget now the name of it.
Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare.
Exactly, yes. I'm a huge fan of that book. It's one of the creepiest books I've read.
It's one of those books, it all seems, a lot of it, just so damn far out and off the wall, but something about it, you know, rings true.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that spooky book. I'm always impressed when someone cites him too, because you don't hear too much about it.
A major influence on him was James Shelby Downard.
Oh yeah.
And are you familiar with their piece King Kill 33?
That rings a bell, but I'm not anything that I could speak to.
Yeah, it basically deals with the Kennedy assassination, how it was a Freemasonic conspiracy.
Oh, okay.
How it was based on long lines, longitude and latitude. And,
yeah, yeah.
Daily plazas on the 33 degree and all these type of things. And right now I'm working on a long piece about James Shelby Downard and his life. So that's the latest thing I'm working on, who once again was a big influence on Michael Anthony Hoffman.
Nice, nice. Is Hoffman still around nowadays? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, he is?
He's very accessible, too.
Oh, cool. I'll have to
I've been in contact recently. I plan to interview him at some point for this project. One of the things about Hoffman is he's a revisionist historian, so he catches a lot of flack about that, and a lot of people refuse just to have anything to do with him or consider his conspiracy or paranormal work just because he's, you know, also written about, you know, the Holocaust being a hoax.
Yeah, yeah, I noticed that too about him, that he catches a lot of heat for that, and that's just a portion of what he writes about. So
sure, yeah,
kind of hurts his overall work. But I found what he wrote in Secret Society: Psychological Warfare to be just a wild book.
Yeah,
and the, particularly what you had spoken to was the revelation of method, which I thought was pretty prescient of an observation by him. I think there might be something to that.
Well, I certainly do too, and I think it's on a par with what conspiracy theorist, or maybe a better term that Ken Thomas uses, is parapolitical researcher.
Oh, that's nice. I like that.
By the name of Mae Russell, who I mentioned before, she had what she called the strategy of tension, which is kind of similar to the revelation of the method. Mae contended that these different things going on in the late 60s, Altamont and Kent State, and also the Manson family murders, were basically engineered by them, those behind the scenes, the cryptocracy, to bring about this strategy of tension, which would basically create the atmosphere where people would be willing to give up their civil liberties, and a police state would be ushered in under these pretexts. And a lot of people have seen the same thing happen here with 9/11.
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounds a lot like today.
Yeah. And, maybe that's the
next stage.
Or the latest installment of May's strategy of tension, or Downard's revelation of the method, was 9/11. And also what happened at Abu Ghraib.
Oh, yeah, the prison thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some sort of psyops or psychological terror that was meant to go out to the public.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah. It was an intentional release to mess with people's minds, pretty much, and condition them.
Yes.
Now, in your book here, you also have a pretty lengthy profile on Carlos Castaneda. He sounds like he was a pretty big influence on you, or at least a subject you wanted to research.
Well, yeah, that ended up going, 12 or 13 pages.
Well, it was pretty lengthy, but it was an interesting read. And because I've never really heard of this guy before. But yeah, I'm sorry. I'm only 25, so I'm only about like knee high into the esoteric pool now.
I got into, Castaneda was a huge influence on the 60s. Counterculture. His first book was The Teachings of Don Juan, A Yaqui Way of Knowledge, where, and this was basically his doctoral thesis at UCLA in the mid-60s. It came out in the later 60s, and he was an anthropology student, and anyway, presented this story where he had gone to Mexico, and over a period of years had become the student for this medicine man, Don Juan. And this eventually led to several bestsellers over the years, chronicling his experiences using hallucinogenic drugs with Don Juan and becoming a man of knowledge and a sorcerer himself. Basically, for people who've looked into this, a lot of us have come to acknowledge that it was kind of a big hoax, but Castaneda fooled a lot of people, a lot of academics, popular culture was taken in by this. I talk about that in the piece, but also hidden in all the bull data, all the bullshit, was a great philosopher and teacher, and so you need to separate the wheat from the chaff, really. And even though he has been kind of shown to be a hoaxer and prankster, that there's some cool messages and things to take out of his work.
And so was he? He was a pretty big mainstream name. During the 60s.
Well, really, basically, till his death here a few years back.
Oh, no kidding. I'm so ignorant.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, I'm not kidding. I'm not agreeing with you. But
I know.
He's huge. I got into him when I was in my teens and, starting to experiment with things. And it was like one of those books back then that everybody read. We were reading Tolkien, The Hobbit, all that stuff was popular back then, and all the Castaneda books. And so he had a huge, huge audience out there. He made millions. But he was always a recluse, and after I finished writing that article, the story continued to get more bizarre. Other books that have come out about Castaneda, that he was basically running a cult.
Oh, really?
The last years of his life. And there's a good book by Amy Wallace that talks about that.
So in the article, you put him on par with Timothy Leary and another guy. You'd say that the triumvirate of the LSD movement, sort of.
Yeah, and I forgot who the heck that was. Probably Gordon Lawson.
Yeah, that was it. Yep.
Yeah, those three basically launched the psychedelic movement. They had a big part in it. Gordon Wasson really discovered the magic mushroom, psilocybin.
Oh, no kidding.
Back in the 50s or so, when he went back and did to Mexico and discovered the different brujus or medicine workers back there. And basically it was his stories and articles and experimentation. I think eventually he wrote an article for Life magazine in the late 50s, early 60s, which exposed, the Western world to this. And then not soon after, he had people wandering over there and looking for medicine workers so they could experiment with mushrooms. And, of course, we know what Leary did to popularize the LSD.
And so, Ken, how would you compare Castaneda's influence with those two guys?
Castaneda's influence on a whole is probably much greater than Wasson or Leary.
Oh, you think so?
Yeah. Just you know, for popularizing kind of all talking about Native American traditions and the use of medicinals and psychoactive plants. I mean, he was really during the 70s and 80s, and I guess he died somewhere in the 90s, just a huge icon.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, you're just a little bit too young, you know, to have been part of that whole thing. But I think you get into anybody in my age range who's experimented, you know, with and you know, been involved in the underground or the counterculture, they all know Castaneda's been a big influence.
And you think now, you said a lot of his stuff, it turns out, was probably bogus.
Mm-hmm.
But was but there was some good let me think of the right word here. There was some good philosophy cloaked under that.
I think you know, Castaneda was a very astute student of metaphysics, and he did his time reading through all the great works, and he was able to synthesize all of this stuff. And you know, the time was right for him with the 60s and the counterculture really to get his whole message out. So he was tapping into a lot of other things, Eastern religions and different philosophies and the whole psychedelic movement, basically once again synthesizing that, all of that together for, you know, folks to use. Kind of, and that, you know, coming out of the 60s into the 70s, people were basically creating their own self-styled religions, for want of a better term. What works for you personally, kind of, you know, disengaging themselves from organized religions and all this stuff, but still tapped in, you know, it was still a religious movement or mystical movement of sorts. So, you know, the Learys and the Castanedas and these guys were there kind of pointing the way.
Now, do you think as he got older, like towards the 80s, and then like as it got later in the 80s or whatever, do you think he sort of, I don't want to say sold out, but do you think he sort of realized that now at this point he was an icon and could sort of ride?
Well, hearing the recent stories I heard about him, I don't think he sold out. I think he just whacked out. He got nuts and was basically running, overseeing a cult of female admirers.
Wow.
Who shaved their heads, and of whom committed suicide after he died.
Oh, no.
If you really look into this, there, he was very reclusive somewhere in the kind of got the timeline screwed up, but he reemerged with a group he called Tinson Gritty. I think I have the pronunciation wrong, but he was putting on seminars, and basically it was movements similar to Tai Chi type movements, and he put on these seminars, and he had this huge group around him at this time. And what it appears now, this group was women that he kind of, well, for want of a better term, brainwashed and had sexually relationships. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
He really fucked over a lot of their the heads of these women.
Yeah.
And basically had a cult around him where he was just a real strange scene.
Now, do you think he sort of believed all this stuff he was pushing towards the end there, or was it just sort of like, you know, hey, you know, I'm just going to take advantage of this?
I think he made himself, pulled himself into believing, you know, what he talked about. he created this illusionary world around him, and I think eventually started believing it.
And why do you think he was so reclusive?
I think from what I've gathered, he wasn't comfortable with fame, and part of the path of the warrior that he talks about in his book was that you had to be set aside from the rest of society, and you were on what he called the path of heart. You're basically on your own, and I think by being in the limelight, that you lose a part of yourself. There was very few photos of Castaneda. You know, he believed in that soul catcher type thing.
Probably the Amish.
Yeah, just this whole world he'd constructed around himself. Part of it being the warrior, following the path of the warrior, meant you had to be a recluse or separate yourself from the rest of society.
I hear you. All right. Now, one thing I wanted to mention was the article on Ronnie Raines and roller derby, because I'm actually, I would say, a casual roller derby fan.
is it still going on these days?
Well, I'm a student of professional wrestling, so everybody who sort of follows professional wrestling is a researcher, sort of, knows about roller derby.
Uh-huh.
And so when I read it, I was like, wow, a roller derby article, this is great.
Oh, man, Ronnie Raines was the greatest.
And a lot of people don't realize that roller derby was actually really, really big for a long time in America. And
oh, yeah, it was pretty huge. The heyday for roller games, as they called them, was early 70s, mid-70s. There was a period there where it was on TV every weekend, the Los Angeles Thunderbirds, that's the team Ronnie Raines was on.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it got pretty popular. Raines was the ultimate showman. Originally, he was an adversary of the Thunderbirds. He was on whatever different teams they had, the New York Bombers, and he was back then known as Psycho Ronnie Raines. Psycho in a bad way. He was...
Yeah.
He'd do whatever nasty things to defeat his opponents. When he went to the L.A. Thunderbirds, he transformed into a good guy, you know, the same thing they do in wrestling.
Yep, yep.
He was still the psycho. He did all these hilarious antics, none of which, from what I've been able to gather, a lot of the films of... you know, the Thunderbirds, a lot of that was destroyed by the owner. So, the classic Ronnie Raines stuff, unless somebody else can track it down, is basically gone. I have a few videotapes I've been able to acquire over the years, but none of it was the real classic, hilarious, funny stuff that Raines used to do. And, He was obviously a huge influence on professional wrestling. None of these guys nowadays, you know, could hold a candle to him. I like the one guy I've seen who I thought's pretty good is Mick Foley.
Okay, yeah, yep.
And he does some funny stuff that's on the par with Ronnie Raines as well. Yeah, Ronnie Raines was just a hilarious performer.
So growing up,
and a very talented athlete too.
Of course, that's they always get tagged with it's a tough sport in general, wrestling or roller derby.
Yeah.
And so you growing up in California, you must have been right in the thick of the roller derby mania then.
I guess I'm not sure if it ever really was a mania. It didn't get anywhere as big as wrestling is these days. I think the mania was probably what they're trying to make us think that it was. they used to advertise it as America's fastest growing spectator sport on the promo to roller derby and roller games. But, it got somewhat popular, but it was never huge. It had kind of almost a fringy cult following.
Yeah, sort of like professional wrestling did before it.
Yeah, I was I was into professional wrestling back then, big time wrestling.
Okay.
And some of the there were some pretty strange, funny performers there. One was the Great Mephisto.
Yep.
And this was the period of time you had Ray Stevens and Peter Maiva and Kenji Shibuya.
Okay, yeah, the good old days of professional wrestling before it got all corporate.
Yeah, one guy I'm getting into these days is going back and looking at the films of El Santo.
Oh, yes, El Santo, probably one of Mexico's greatest wrestlers of all time.
Oh, no, the greatest.
Yes, well, all right. Buried with his mask on.
Is that right?
Yeah, I've never heard that.
Well, I'm just kind of getting into researching his history. Maybe I'll write something about the great one.
Yes, yeah, he was buried with his mask on. He was that famous. I don't think anyone ever saw him without his mask, and his son is actually probably one of Mexico's biggest stars now. So.
Oh, okay.
El Hijo del Santo.
There you go.
Yeah. Now, what do you think happened with roller derby? Why do you think it just died out like that?
Part of the problem, from what I gathered, is just the expense of putting on these the performances. You need performances, or whatever you want to call them. You need, and they're having problems with it today. They're trying to bring back some. They have all girl leagues now with roller derby.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They're big in Texas and some other place in there. Using little sexy young ladies, and that's the problem they've had bringing it back over the years, just the expense of doing it, and you need a special bank track. So basically you need auditoriums set up for these, or if you're going to be moving that bank track around, that's a pretty expensive prospect. So, you know, I think a lot of it was the cost and being able to sustain all of that.
Yeah. Well, they tried to
Go ahead.
Well, they say they tried to make a comeback 15 years ago or so on a syndicated show. I think you mentioned it in the article, actually. It was called Roller Games, I think.
Oh, yeah. It's been that long now.
Yeah.
Kind of an extreme version of...
Yeah, it had the wall and... Yeah, it was pretty. Yeah, they had like six teams, and they had the Thunderbirds on there. So, but that only lasted one season. That was on in syndication. So, apparently, it wasn't. It didn't really. And then they tried again, maybe 5 years ago.
Yeah, but you know, part of it, I'm sure, has to do with the personalities they get. You know, they really need some strong personalities, like a Ronnie Raines, to sustain that. You know. You have some of those in wrestling now, and they're making big money, so why they want to? I think that's how it would have to happen. Somebody'd have to put a lot of money into it once again and really cultivate some big stars.
Yeah.
And, of course, you need a lot of sex in there as well.
Yeah. Well,
there's so much competition these days, too, you know.
Oh, for entertainment?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Exactly, yeah. Yeah, well, roller derby's a pretty obscure sort of sport genre that not too many people, they only hear about it in passing or something, but it's a pretty fascinating little...
Yeah, it was once again, one of those niches during that period of time. You know, I was just at the right age at the right time to be exposed to it.
And, all right, and the final thing I want to ask you about on the Beast of is Greg Bishop and how he blew your cover in the beginning, and you must be friends with Greg Bishop then, right?
Damn him, I was.
What are you guys, running buddies or something out there in California?
Let's see, how our relationship started kind of writing for the same magazines in the early 90s. Once again, I got involved in the whole zine movements, all the underground publishing going on. I gravitated towards those magazines that were doing conspiracies and paranormal and all this type of stuff, and that had a certain sensibility, sense of humor, and the Excluded Middle was one of those magazines, along with Crash Collision and Steam Shovel Press. So networks started back then with myself, Greg Bishop, Robert Larson was involved with Excluded Metal, Peter Stinchel. Then you had Crash Collision with West Nations. You also had a guy who goes by the pseudonym of John Carter, who wrote Sex and Rockets about John Whiteside's Parsons. Who else am I forgetting? Ken Thomas was one of the groups, Steam Shovel Press. And so networking with these folks, and eventually we agreed to start meeting up once a year at events we called Kookouts. different places out in the desert. Met in Sedona one year, and so anyway, just started a group of like-minded souls that get together, you know, people into all this wacky stuff. And so that's how I met Greg, going to the Kookouts. And, you know, I've been a frequent contributor to the Excluded Metal. And also Greg is a renowned UFO hoaxer.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Why you say that?
At one of our Kookouts, he staged a UFO hoax.
Oh, no.
Basically, since he exposed me, I'll expose him here. Using some kind of Chinese lamp that was tethered with put a balloon to it, and
yeah,
put it up there. Actually, I helped him launch it and move it back over to the rest of the group, and it was up there for a few minutes, and all of a sudden, I was like, wow, what's that over there? And so they eventually figured it out, but yeah, there you go. I can't trust him.
Oh, no. So that's pretty cool. You know, like, you still have these Kookouts?
We try to. It's been a couple of years since we had one. There's going to be a someone proposed. No, I forgot. Yeah, Miles Lewis is another person involved with Kookouts. He has a website. Elf Infested Spaces is a magazine he put out. His website is elfus.net. Anyway, Miles suggested in April we all go out to a retro UFO symposium they're having in Flanders, California, there at Giant Rock,
okay, yeah,
where the Integratron is. We had a Kookout in that area, so maybe if we can get everybody together, we'll try to do that again this year.
Nice, nice. All right, now is there anything else in the Beast of that you think I should touch on that people would be interested in before we move on to the Thornleaf book?
I think we covered a lot of ground there on
Yeah,
Beast.
There's tons of other stuff in there. I highly recommend it. It's a great read, especially if you're like me, you're just discovering Adam Gorightly. Pick up the book, you can read it. There's excerpts from the other books, and then, you know, you're going to be like, I want all of these other books.
Damn right.
That's how I felt when I finished it. I was like, where's this Manson book? I want to read it.
Cool. With all the books, once again, you can get them at adamgorightly.com, and I can sell them to you directly there if folks want signed copies.
That does it for this week's edition of Been All of America Audio Season 1. Next week, more with Adam Gorightly. We're going to talk about Kerry Thornley and how he got wrapped up into the Kennedy assassination and his fascinating story. And that, of course, will be next week on December 10th, 2005. I want to thank Adam Gorightly for sitting down and talking to us. I also want to thank Leslie and Chiron of BeenAllOfAmerica.com for your continued support and help with the audio series. And, of course, I want to thank all you great listeners out there who have been following us along here at Been All of America Audio Season 1. Until you hear from me next week, this is Tim Beenall, signing off.